Energy Committee meeting to order here, and I'd just like to introduce in attendance here, we have Representative Peterson, welcome, Representative Sadler, Representative Pruitt, Representative Lynn, Representative Tuck, and myself, Rep Foster, for the attendance. Just a couple housekeeping notes here. If you've got cell phones, please put those on silence. And if anyone has any requests for hearings in the future, we do have the memo out on that. So please, if you don't have that, we've got a copy of that here. And if you are going to be testifying, please do note your name for the record. And I'd like to introduce also the staff, the energy staff here that we have. I've got in my staff here, Chris Clark. And then with Representative Pruitt's office here, we have Dirk Kraft. Is that right? Dirk is in the back there. Purpose of today's meeting is going to be reviewing the Rail Belt Large Hydro Evaluation Preliminary Decision. We won't be taking testimony, and we won't be looking at House Bill 103. That will come later, no later than February 8th, or no earlier, I should say. But with the AEA, and if we could have the folks come up to the table here, I'd like to introduce our presenters today. So we'll be just receiving an overview, and then we may have some time for testimony. I understand there might be a person online who is interested. With us we have today the Alaska Energy Authority Acting Executive Director Michael Harper. We also have AEA Technical Engineer Brian Carey and the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, as well as AEA Deputy Director of Operations Sarah Fisher Goad. And as we look forward, just to kind of give you a quick update, we will be at some point looking at SB 220 as well as HB 306. So with that, is there anything that I'm missing, Representative Pruitt, that you'd like to add before we ask for the presentation to begin?
No, I think you covered it all. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. And I should also mention that Representative Pruitt is the co-chair of Energy, and so we will be the gavel will be going back and forth, I think, on an alternating basis. So with that, I believe, Mr. Harper, would you like to start?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the Energy Committee and folks in the audience. We're pleased to be here today to give you an overview of the large hydro project that we've been tasked with to do a comparison study between Chacachamna and the Susitna. My job is going to be fairly easy. I'm just going to introduce Brian Carey, the principal engineer in charge here, has been driving the study, and Sarah Fisher Goad, who's been generally the taskmaster in terms of the financial part of the program. But we're pleased to present our report, and we did this yesterday, of course, before the Senate Resources Committee. We've had some discussion with members here, and we suspect that the slides will go fairly quickly this afternoon, and we're pleased then to answer questions as the committee members have them. So let me introduce Brian Carey, and he'll run through the slides, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And we are scheduled from 3 to 4:30. I expect that we will be out of here by 4:30. We had a discussion just for those in the audience, and I believe this presentation will go about 20 minutes, and then we'll have time for questions. And so, Mr. Carey, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. For the record, Brian Carey, Alaska Energy Authority. I'll start out by just giving a brief history of the two projects. This slide shows a map of the South Central area. North of us is the Susitna River with the Watonna site on it, and to the west of us is Chacachamna. And during the course of this presentation, I'll sometimes say Watonna, and sometimes I'll say Susitna Project. Susitna Project would be on the Susitna River. Watonna is the specific location. During the early 1980s, both of these sites were studied by the Alaska Power Authority. Chacachamba was studied. They came up with a cost estimate of somewhere in the vicinity of $1.5 billion at the time. and then they dropped the further studies from Chacachalma at that time. Watana had $130-140 million for the studies done during that time period by a variety of state agencies and others looking at wildlife and fisheries. The original configuration of the Susitna project at that time was to build two dams. One was to be first the Watana Dam at around 885 feet tall, and then following that, they'd go down and build Devil Canyon Dam, which is 30 miles downstream of it. Because of declining state revenue with oil prices going down, they changed it to a three-stage project where Watana would be built to 700 feet tall, but with the ability to raise the height in it at a future date. Then Devil Canyon would be built as a stage two, and then following Devil Canyon being built, they would return back up to Watana and raise the height from 700 feet up to 885 feet. At that time, this would still be costing approximately $5 billion. State revenue in 1984 dropped substantially as oil went down to about $9 a barrel. Also at that time, there was a substantial amount of gas reserves in Cook Inlet, which was going to be providing low-cost gas for electrical generation. Since then, things have changed substantially during the last 5 years. Recognizing that gas reserves in the Cook Inlet were declining and that a lot of the generation that had been built by the utilities is approaching 30 years or more, there is going to have to be a lot of replacement of the generation and transmission of the utilities, and there would have to be something done in regards to where would our energy come from in the future. Starting 5 years ago, there was an integrated resource plan that was produced by Alaska Energy Authority. The final one just came out in last year, and in it, it recommended that the only at the same time last year, the legislators passed a statewide energy goal of 50% renewable energy by 2025. When you look at the possibilities to reach that goal, and when you look at the needs for new generation along the rail belt, the only way you could reach that is you have to have at least one of these two hydros to be able to reach the 50% renewable goal. Even if you were to not build a hydro and you were to just not go with the goal but to just figure out a way to have gas generation, you would still need to be spending billions of dollars on generation upgrades for the utilities, as right now much of the generation was built during the early 80s or late 70s. So following with the integrated resource plan that we need to look at these two hydros, Alaska Energy Authority during the last year came up with a preliminary decision document where we looked more at depth of these two hydros in terms of what the cost would be and what the potential impacts would be of the two. This slide shows the location of Watana. At this point, we are only looking at constructing a powerhouse and dam at the Watana site. We are not doing one for Devil Canyon. This would be 700 feet tall, so sometimes you'll see it being referred to as the Low Watana Project. 700 feet tall is still a very large dam. Approximately 550 feet of that would be above ground. The rest of it would be going down to bedrock below which you can see it. It's approximately 40 miles south of Denali Highway and around 90 miles upstream of where Talkeetna is on the Susitna River. This slide shows the location of the Chacachalma project. It's located just to the east of Lake Clark National Park Preserve and upstream of the Trading Bay State Game Refuge. It would be a lake tap where you divert the water from the existing Chacatnat River over to the MacArthur River Valley. The tunnel would be 10 to 12 miles long depending on where you had it come out. One of the significant portions of the project would be is that you're diverting it from one river system to another river system. And getting into the permitting wise, the resource agencies are going to require you to have some amount of water to continue down the existing river for the existing salmon that go up there and go into the National Park and Preserve. Any of the water that is required to go down the existing river takes away from what the energy would be from the project. On a comparison to environmental, the Sault Ste. At Botana would create a reservoir approximately 39 miles long and up to about 2 miles wide. It's 30 miles above what the significant salmon amount is. During the 80s, they did not find any salmon above where Watauga would be. However, more recently, in 2003, they did find some Chinook in a couple of the streams. So they know that some Chinook make it up there. It's uncertain whether they make it up only during the low water years when the rapids in Devil Canyon are at a lower point or not. There would be some loss of wildlife habitat as that area is covered. However, it's believed that the fisheries impacts would be pretty minimal because very little salmon actually spawned in the Sault Ste. River, and almost all the salmon that's in the Sault Ste. River, 99.9% of the salmon are below this area. They go up the Sault Ste. River and they go into side sloughs and side rivers. In comparison, Chacachama, it has the approximately 40,000 reds at that time travel up through the lake to the national park. Right now, the lake does contain lake trout, belly barden, white, and it's also suspected that salmon spawn in the lake. It has not been proved because the studies were not done, but it is believed that they do spawn there. When you do the diversion of water, and you would first get a change in habitat down the state game refuge where a lot of the wetlands would possibly dry out. And so that would be affecting that area which is used as habitat for salmon in the game refuge. And thus, along with potentially blocking salmon being able to return to the park system, you would affect the salmon downstream substantially. Another big impact would be is with the powerhouse being 10 miles or 15 miles past the existing river up a different river system. Adults, when they return, would tend to go up the wrong river system, and it would be fairly hard to be able to catch most of those salmon and then either truck them over into the lake or bring them back down to the existing river, again, turned around. Juvenile salmon would have the same problems in the sense that juvenile salmon follow the main current out of the lake to be able to go downriver. If you're operating a powerhouse, the largest current that you're going to find in the lake is the current that goes down the powerhouse, through the powerhouse. And so you would have to figure out how to keep the juvenile salmon from going through the powerhouse. There is also the farther concern on you may not be able to license the project under FERC. More recently, the National Park Service sent a letter to FERC, and in it they raised concerns that Lake Kinibuna, which is above the head of the lake, and it is within the park, may be hydrologically connected to the Lake Chacachama. If it is hydrologically connected to it, you cannot license Lake Chacachama as a FERC project without an act of Congress. The energy, so setting up the installed capacity would be approximately 600 megawatts. The annual energy would be approximately 2,600 gigawatt hours per year, which is approximately 50% of what the rail belt uses for electrical energy currently. Chacachama would have a capacity of approximately 300 megawatts. The annual energy of 860 to 1100 gigawatt hours is based on some of the beliefs of what the environmental flows would be down the river. As you have the greater environmental flows to protect the state game refuge downstream and to make sure salmon can return, that reduces the energy farther. At this average energy, that's approximately 20% of the annual rail belt energy, and even in conjunction with other projects, it's unlikely that you'd be able to reach the state's 50% goal. This slide shows the upper line is currently an approximate rail belt electrical demand. It tends to peak during the winter months and decrease during the summer. The lower dashed line is what we believe would be the Chacachama energy with probable environmental restrictions. And the upper line would be Sault Ste. Watauga project what its energy would be. You'll notice both of them have their peak energy during the summertime, and that's because of the environmental flows. We'd have to maintain high flow rates during the summer so that the salmon that are downstream can continue to return to their existing streams and sloughs. The big difference between the two comes during the wintertime. Chalcachalma would not be able to have the winter storage and would not be able to produce that much wintertime energy compared to Susitna. At the amount of energy that you would probably get from Chalcachalma during the wintertime, it's likely to be less than what Bradley Lake Hydro does, whereas Susitna will still have a significant amount of energy during the wintertime that it will be producing and displacing some of the gas that Anchorage is currently use.
Okay, question for real quick, Mr. Chair, through the chair, is that because you'd store up water during the summertime when there's high flow and let it roll during the wintertime?
Mr. Chair, yes, during the summertime, when you have high flow, what you would typically do with, say, Susitna, is you may store 25% of the water during the high flow time periods. So you'll still have very substantial flows going downriver, which would be likely within what the natural variability is during the summertime. But you're able to store a lot of water for the wintertime and then produce more power during the winter.
Thank you.
This slide in regards to Raildale Energy for the next 50 years comes out of the Integrated Resource Plan. If Susitna Hydro was constructed, that would be the yellow on this slide. As you can see from the purple, natural gas would still be required by the utilities for generation. It's just not as much gas would be required for generation in the Anchorage area as what it would be otherwise. This slide on terms of the estimated cost of power, it's a very simple financial look at what the cost per kilowatt hour could be. It is, it does not include the O&M and utility distribution costs. So this is not what you're going to see, a retail customer would not see this. Under this, if you built the Susitna embankment, non-expandable at about $4.5 billion, and there is a state capital contribution of around 50%, and then the remainder was financed at 6% 30-year bonds, you would end up with a cost per kilowatt hour for repaying the loan of a little bit over 6 cents a kilowatt hour. That rate is actually pretty close to what we pay or what the utilities generate power at right now. If the Susitna roller compacted concrete is able to be constructed at the lower cost, it is conceivable that you may be able to end up with generation cost per kilowatt hour, or at least the repayment of loans of around 5 cents per kilowatt hour. The Chalcachalma project would tend to have much higher, it's the cost of energy from Chalcachalma to be much higher, even at approximately 50% state contribution, you'd have a cost per kilowatt hour of around 12 cents per, well, 12 cents per kilowatt hour. So there are many different ways that the state could work in terms of a contribution, whether they do it on a percentage or whether the state was to set what a target generation rate would be and thus change up and down what a contribution could be.
Representative Pruitt, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you talk really briefly about the difference in the Susitna embankment and the Susitna RRC? Can you talk about the pros and the cons just briefly? You don't have to get too deep.
Mr. Chair, actually, if I could go forward about a slide or two,
okay,
I could have some pictures that would show the two different construction methods.
Okay.
The first slide here is of Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project. It's a state-owned project. It's the largest project in the state of Alaska. And this is an embankment dam. It's no fish are present up at Bradley Lake, so there is no fish fish ladders of any kind there. The water that's coming out at the bottom is fish water releases for fish down, lower down the river, closer to where the inlet is. So if it was to be built as an embankment dam, it would be very similar to this, only taller.
And if I could interrupt for just a moment, I wanted to recognize Representative Gatto, who is currently in the Anchorage LIO. So welcome, Representative, and please continue.
Thank you.
The second slide here is Alweda Jordan Hydroelectric Project. It was built using the roller compacted concrete construction. It's using concrete, but one of the differences compared to the older style of concrete dams is you can place the concrete down much quicker using dump trucks. You don't need to do thin lifts. They could be fairly thick lifts at a time. And because of that, you can construct them much quicker than what used to be done with concrete dams. And it also, of course, in a project like this, it makes a huge difference in the amount of material. If you were to build the Lowatana expandable embankment dam, it's around 33 million yards of material. If you were to build Lowatana using RCC construction, which is the roller compacted concrete construction, I believe it's around 7.5 million yards. And so the amount of material, using the embankment dam, it has to be very wide, very broad, as you build it up slowly in a triangle. But with the concrete, you can go at a much steeper rate going up. And so it's the volume of material is much less. From that reason, it's one of the reasons why it can be built at a much quicker speed.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tuck.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sorry, can you give me those numbers again? There's 33 million tons or million cubic feet?
Cubic yards.
Cubic yards, I'm sorry. And then what was it again on the rolling compact concrete?
I believe it's about 7.5 million yards.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
By the same token, as if you were to later expand this, raise the height by the 185 feet, because with embankment dam, you're dealing with a triangle. To raise it up the height, just the 185 feet, it will require another 30 million yards. So to get to the 885 feet, you would require a total of 63 million yards of materials, whereas for the roller compacted concrete, to raise it up to the higher stage, it's I believe it's, I can't say the exact amount because I don't remember what it is, but it's substantially less because you're on a much steeper angle that you're constructing at, and so it's probably only another 7 million at the most.
Representative Sadler?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. Sorry, Mr. Carey. Roller compacted, what does that mean? Do they roll it versus how compacting it some other way? Or?
It's the specs on the, Mr. Chair, the specs on the concrete are not necessarily as tight as what the conventional concrete is. But one of the big differences is that they're able to put it on much thicker layers. One of the problems with concrete is if you have a thick layer at one time, it starts heating up. And so then you've got to do a substantial amount of cooling to keep it from cracking. In the case of roller compacted concrete, they're able to use other materials such as fly ash, which gives them some strength. But they're able to be able to put it on in much thicker blocks at a time. And so, and as they put it on, then they can, it's almost like a wet sand in the back of a dump truck. And then you can use a roller machine and vibrate it to get all the air voids out of it.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know what the tallest dam using roller compacted concrete that has been built thus far, what's the biggest one they've done that way?
Mr. Chairman, there are roller compacted concrete dams, I believe, that are over 700 feet at this time. There are roller compacted concrete dams which are under design or maybe starting construction that are going to be reaching close to 1,000 feet around the world.
Please continue.
Timeline for Susitna, under an aggressive schedule, but a doable schedule-wise, the licensing to get to the point where you would do the final application document would be approximately 3.5 to 4 years. And then you'd have several years of FERC follow-up where you'd be answering questions from FERC and starting to work on your final design. After that would be followed by approximately 4.5 years of construction, and so that you would be able to come out and be able to start generating power in approximately 11 years. So the next steps to occur is we're going to be holding public meetings. The first one will be in Fairbanks on February 24th, and then I believe Talkeetna, February 28th, Palmer, then Anchorage. The dates and the venues are on the Alaska Energy Authority webpage, and we will be adding also a public meeting to occur down at Kenai or Soldotna in mid-March. Some of the, currently we have some environmental term contractors. They are doing aquatic gap studies and also wildlife gap studies to determine where there's data gaps from the 1980s that we need to know about for the licensing. Once that's done, we will meet with the resource agencies, and they will be reviewing that information, and we will come up with a study plan to determine what studies need to be occurring during the next couple of years so that we can fill those gaps and that they will be able to determine what the environmental flows are and what mitigation may occur with the project. On the engineering standpoint, we recently, we do have an engineering firm that was brought on board as of earlier this week. It's Montgomery Watson. During the next year or two, we will be doing mapping using LIDAR to get high-definition maps of the area, forming working groups with various stakeholders in the project, determining all the landowners of the area, working on access questions that do we use the same access as was developed in the 1980s, or do we use different access? And then one of the other things we'd be doing is later on this year, we would, if we were to receive authorization and funding, we would go ahead and file with FERC the notice of intent and the preliminary application document to actually make it official at FERC. Until you actually make it official at FERC, some of the resource agencies do not want to spend too much time on your project because they've got a lot of other work to do, and they figure that until you're serious, they don't want to be serious either. So that would be an important thing for the Alaska Energy Authority to proceed to. It will also start the clock ticking in other various ways. The study plans, you want to have the various study plans, environmental study plans done under FERC auspice. Engineering standpoint, we would be continuing to evaluate the embankment versus the roller compacted concrete dam and coming up with what would be the best powerhouse type location wise and specifications on it.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where are some of those resource agencies? Can you give us just a couple of examples? A few?
Any of the project will have to be licensed through FERC. And in terms of the resource agencies, it's the big ones are Fish and Wildlife, Bureau of Land Management, National Park Service, National Marine Fisheries, State Fish and Game, and State Department of Natural Resources. All those agencies have under FERC what's called mandatory conditioning powers. And so when license goes through, they have the ability to put conditions on the license. FERC cannot just overrule those conditions, and so they have, I'll say the resource agencies have tremendous power to be able to decide how the project is to be built, what the environmental flows are going to be during what time period. And so they will be ones that we have to continually work with during this licensing process. It is our ability to get a license is very good. The question is when you get a license, is what conditions come in with it. And without the knowledge, specific knowledge, the resource agencies are going to err on the very conservative standpoint and put conditions on it with your environmental flows to make it harder for you to operate the way you want it to operate.
Thank you. And I know some of those are federal agencies, some of those are state agencies. How do you think the state of Alaska is going to favor with some of the federal agencies in trying to have favorable conditions?
Mr. Chair, I think we have been talking with some of the agencies in regards to this project. It's they will be doing their duty as they see it. However, this project, for various reasons, has quite a lot of advantages that most of the hydropower projects do not have, with the exception of perhaps a couple hundred Chinook. Fish are not present up there, or at least using the river. And so you get past a lot of fish issues that most hydropower projects in Lower 48 have to deal with. Another, and it's also heavily, I won't say, it's generally a glacial river. A significant amount of its water is coming from the glaciers in the Alaska Range. And so from that, the impact on this project is considerably less than what a traditional hydropower project would be. And I think that with the proper conditions, I think that the ones up here believe it's a very doable project.
Okay. Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sadler and then Representative Peterson.
Real briefly, thank you. Is the Environmental Protection Agency one of the resource agencies?
Mr. Chair, I'm pretty certain it is. It's it doesn't jump into my mind immediately. However, by the time you're done with a project like this, the amount of permits that you're going to need is somewhere, it's likely to be 150, 200 various permits by different agencies. And some of the work that you do at some point will most likely require Environmental Protection Agency permits.
Thank you. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering how far from the current electric grid this would be located, and has any estimate been made as to how much additional funding would be necessary to upgrade the power lines to be able to distribute this new electricity?
Mr. Chair, the Watonna site is approximately 35 to 40 miles to the east of where the existing northern intertie is located. The cost estimate that we've done is to bring the power lines to the intertie. During the coming years, there will be upgrades to the intertie that will be likely occurring that are required regardless of whether Susitna is built or not. Those upgrades will make it easier for Susitna power to travel. The cost for some of those upgrades are likely in the range of perhaps 500 to 800 million. And some of those upgrades will be for the ability to export power, say, from Cook Inlet up to Fairbanks or back, depending on what prices are doing. And the utilities are wanting these various upgrades regardless of this project, and so they will be prioritizing the list of what the best upgrades would have to be.
Thank you. Oh, question, Representative Tom? Oh, no, okay. Please continue. Thank you.
And this is the last slide here. It's there are many hydroelectric projects in the U.S. that are more than 100 years old. Actually, the average age of a hydroelectric project in the U.S., I believe, is around 50 years. A project on the Susitna would be expandable. You could either build additional dams up or downstream, or you could, if you wanted to design the expandability, you could raise the height for Watonna as it is. It'll provide you predictable, low-cost energy for hundreds of years, realistically. And it's secure in the sense that if at some point we may be importing some of our fuel supplies up here, and those fuel supplies could be affected by other events around the world. And so as long as you've got a substantial amount of your energy coming from hydroelectric, you're insulated from those impacts. Most of the, right now, if we start importing a substantial amount of fuel supplies, say if we have to bring gas into the state for Anchorage anyway, all the money for that fuel will be traveling out of state, whereas this way we're able to keep much more of the jobs and the funds in state. Susitna is required for the state to be able to reach its 50% renewable statewide energy policy by 2025. And state participation in some form can make the energy approximately the same cost as what the existing energy is being generated at, and certainly lower in the long term, because if you look at long term with the hydro, its cost tends to be pretty flat over the life of it for the next 50 or 100 years, whereas if you're building gas or coal or some other method, that cost is continually rising over time.
Thank you. Does that conclude your
report? My slides, Chairman.
We thank you very much for bringing us up to speed on the work that you've done. I do have someone on the phone here. Rich Wilson, are you still there?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, if you could just introduce yourself and the organization, your affiliation, and I believe you have a question. And welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, with me here today is one of my colleagues in our Alaska Ratepayers group, Bill Knoll, and if you have questions of either one of us after we're done, I'll just take a couple of minutes here. We have an organization, Representative Gatto is here with me. You were introduced earlier. The strategy that our organization came up with after being very concerned about the volatility of electric rates over the past 10 years is to levelize it any way we can and keep it under control. To make it affordable, we think that the best thing to do is what is being proposed. This was Susitna project at Wautauna. And that will provide us with predictable and affordable price of electricity for the rail belt for at least 100 years. We support that. We also support the other findings of the decision document. We think that was an excellent step that the Alaska Energy Authority took in coming to narrowing the field of decisions. And finally, I will just say that I have three strategies or three goals that our group has come up with over the last 2.5 years of our existence. We've been working very hard as citizens to inform ourselves about this and answer questions from policymakers. Number one is we endorsed the governor's proposal for $65 million to do the FERC application. And we, however, go beyond that. We think that we need to, we propose an additional $65 million to get to the construction stage. Secondly, an independent agency for the development and construction and maintenance of this project is necessary, it being the largest state-sponsored project ever. I can go into details if there are any questions on that, to the extent that we've developed them at this stage. We have developed our own proposed authorizing legislation that could be used in consideration of this issue. The third goal we have is to immediately start building a project development fund to actually do the construction. It'll take the if the legislature decides to go along with the proposed Bradley Lake model to finance the project, it'll be 50% equity by the state, and that will take a project fund of in the neighborhood of $2 billion, as Brian mentioned. And we believe that's an absolutely essential thing to accomplish the goal of a basic infrastructure for the future of the Alaskans that would benefit, which is a large, large group of us. We believe that this is an excellent project. We want to be a part of the public dialogue as we go along, and that's why we're here today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to offer our comments. I don't have a specific question except that we would certainly like to see the three goals that we've set forth considered by the legislature. Thank you.
We certainly appreciate your input, Mr. Wilson, and it's duly noted. Thank you. We also have, I believe, another handout that I, Sarah Fisher Goad, were you regarding the planning and the timeline and the scheduling of different phases of the project, were you going to review that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Sarah Fisher Goad, Deputy Director of Operations for the Alaska Energy Authority. This schedule actually, it didn't fit well on a slide for the PowerPoint presentation. This schedule has been worked on by Brian and our contractor, and now that MWH is on board, they'll be working to help refine this schedule. I will point out on this schedule, there is a space in between where it pretty much shows you where the $10 million that was appropriated last year and the proposed $65 million this year gets us to the project. It's about in the middle of the page, and so this schedule is we wanted to at least provide a high level approach on how we would get from where we are now to constructing the project, but understanding that there's more detail to be put in here and there's probably some refinement to go on.
Any questions? Representative Tuck?
I kind of want to back up a little bit. Are our Alaska Ratepayers Group still with us by any chance?
Are you still there, Mr. Wilson?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Wilson. This is Representative Tuck. The $65 million for the FERC application, and then you said $65 million for the construction. Did you guys, is that, how do you guys come up with that number?
We understand that there's a phase after you submit your FERC application, which Brian referred to. There's a phase after that where the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission actually goes through a very lengthy EIS process and reviews the engineering and so forth. And that process will take a lot of effort on the part of the sponsor, the state. And so that is the second piece that we discussed. It may be too much to bite off at the initial stage here, but it should be kept in mind as that's what would do, we understand, something in that neighborhood would get us to the point of actually starting construction.
And, Mr. Chair, and then the independent agency for development and construction, are you looking at a different agency within the state of Alaska? Is that what you're hoping to create?
Let me ask my colleague Bill Knoll to comment, if I may.
Yes, sir, and hello to all the group co-chairs and members. Thank you, Representative Tuck. This is Bill Knoll, and I'm speaking here from Anchorage. The answer is yes. We looked at a couple of different scenarios and how it could be done. All of them are very natural, easy to address. An expansion of the currently existing ADA, or currently existing Alaska Energy Authority, making sort of a large division, for example, in the Alaska Energy Authority. The concepts aren't very difficult to surmount. Resurrecting the Alaska Power Authority of fond memory for many of us. What we surmised was that this is such a big project, just the sheer dimension of it, as Rich mentioned a little bit earlier, actually the largest single project ever undertaken by the state of Alaska itself, not counting things like the pipeline, which were oil producers and so on. Looking at other models such as BC Hydro, the New York State Power Authority, concepts that were envisioned by the likes of Senator Ernest Grady, a project of such a dimension looks like, and as you know, I used to be vice chair of both ADA and Alaska Energy Authority when I was commissioner of commerce. With all due respect to the people I know, I think I know each and every person on that staff, or those staffs, and I have a deep respect for them. But it seems, and named the people like U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, EPA, BLM, FERC, real big players in the national scene and would be in our state scene, that this particular project probably is due its own people who 24/7 live and breathe this this project and don't, if I may use the word, distracted, and don't get distracted when they come to the office with other important projects or programs such as ECD or wind power out in villages, all of which have their own demands, and some of them are very vital to those communities. So we thought, to summarize, bottom line, that the dimension and this program needs its own special focus, and we drafted, out of the experience of some of our members, legislation, enacting legislation that we've supplied to the governor and to the chief of staff, and toward that end. Long answer to a short question, but it's a very important project.
Hello. Thank you, Bill. And Mr. Chair, can I ask a question on the last slide to the presenters?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. Brian, when you said that the cisternit benefits greater than 100-year life, I thought you said that average life of dams is 50 years?
Mr. Chair, the 50 years, that's of dams that are still working. Those are not, the average age of existing dams is around 50 years. The average life is, we don't really know what the life of those dams are.
And follow up, Mr. Chair. And then what about siltation, you know, because that's glacier-fed. Does that have an effect on the life of our turbines and how long we can keep that dam?
Mr. Chair, in regards to siltation, substantial silt comes into the reservoir. However, at 39 miles long, what happens is most of the silt will drop out. Under the original Watonna scheme of 885 feet, the came up with 1,700 years before it's going to affect the active storage, I believe. And so in regards to even low Watonna here, you're looking at a greater than 100-year life before you're going to be affecting the active storage area. It may have some effect in terms of the life of the turbine blades. We're unsure at this time. Bradley Hydro is mostly glacier-fed. At this point, the runners are not showing any damage by the silt going through because enough of the heavy silt is dropping out in the reservoir that the runners are not being harmed by the silt.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
On the Bradley Hydro, how far, what's the distance between that? Because you said 30 miles is for Watonna. How far is it for Bradley Lake?
Mr. Chair, the Bradley Lake is, I'm going to believe, less than 10 miles away from where some of the glaciers are located at. And in the case of Watonna, the reservoir is 39 miles long, so most of the silt will drop out and not go through the powerhouse. And actually, the water that comes out of Watonna will be a cleaner water than was beforehand.
And one additional one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then how far for Devil's Canyon would that be if they do the phase two of that?
Mr. Chair, Devil's Canyon is the original Devil's Canyon project would be approximately 30 miles downstream of Watonna.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Brian. Are there any other questions? Representative Pruitt.
Real quick, and then I'll let you guys get back. On the siltation issue, how the siltation further down past the dam, will there be any effects on the river farther down? That we would need to be would probably come up and would be a concern in the permitting.
Mr. Chair, what has came up recently in regards to that is one of the large contributors of silt to the Susitna River is the Chilitna River, where it comes in at Talkeetna. The flows of Susitna probably push some of that silt downriver. That is an area of if the Susitna flow itself is a little bit cleaner coming down. And if you change the flows a little bit, the question will come up how that will affect the silt that's coming out of Chilitna River and depositing downstream. This is coming up in the hydrological data gap, and we will be doing additional studies on it this year, or probably not this year in terms of the hydrological data, but next year.
Okay. Thank you.
Additional questions? Did you have any other anything else? For the committee?
It's Representative Gatto. Can I get a word in?
Absolutely, Representative Gatto.
Have we looked at, you know, I know we deal with Chakachamna and Watonna. Are there other alternatives as far as dams are concerned that have been considered and have been rejected? And then the final portion of what I wanted to ask was, if indeed we get a gas line, does that nullify the need for alternative forms of energy such as hydro? And then if we don't get a gas line, does that make the hydro actually imperative?
Mr. Chair, first in regards to other dams, one of the other ones we're looking at is on Glacier Fork. However, Glacier Fork has very little water storage, and so it'd be able to provide power during the summer months and provide very little energy during the winter months. The other dams that are around the state, for any dam of any significant size, you're going to get into fish issues much more so than these projects. And so there may be a couple of smaller dams, so if the 5 or 10 megawatt size, which could be built. But even that, it's really hard to find a location to put a dam without having salmon present. In regards to the gas line, this will reduce the amount of gas that's needed for power generation. The utilities will still need gas for power generation in Anchorage. Homeowners will still need gas for heating purposes. And so they're very definitely, the gas equation will need to be solved. This will reduce the need for the gas, and it will also bring the state to the 50% renewable goal.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What's the ownership, the land ownership of the land surrounding this? Is it state land? So how is it classified? What's the population?
Mr. Chairman, for one of the tasks that we will be doing this year will be identifying all the landowners in the area. The major landowners we already know are the BLM, Siri, Tyonic Native Corporation. And so there could be additional landowners in that area. We will be investigating that. And as to population, a couple of lakes in the vicinity have lodges, and so there would be a couple of people that live in the vicinity. They do not live where the reservoir would be located at.
A follow-up, and then Representative Lynn.
And it, is there any mineralization that would be affected, any mineral areas that would be affected by this? Either covered up or
Mr. Chairman, I'm uncertain on that. I haven't read up on that portion yet.
Representative Lynn.
Chairman, this is Representative Gatto again.
We've got Representative Lynn, and then we'll come back to you there, Representative Gatto.
Excuse me. In reference to Representative Gatto's earlier question here, does the construction of a gas line negate the need for a dam, or would a dam eliminate the need for a gas pipeline? Are they exclusive of each other, or can they work together?
Mr. Chairman, we believe that both projects can occur. One project does not mean that the other project goes away. If you have a dam, you will still need the gas regardless. And how that gets solved is a different question. If you have a gas line and you choose not to have a hydro, you will at the future have higher energy costs as you're burning the gas, and you will not be able to make 50% renewable.
Thank you.
Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Assuming the all-in cost is $5 billion, which should include the dam and the transmission lines, what would the price of electricity be delivered to Anchorage or delivered to Fairbanks?
Mr. Chairman, in regards to the electricity that's delivered to those locations, first I'll say the price, the retail price would be likely similar to what it is now. It depends on the utility you have. For Fairbanks, it may be lowering the cost. For Anchorage, it may be the same cost. However, the retail price by the different utilities is fairly variable. And so going from MLMP all the way up to Golden Valley or Homer Electric. And so it depends on the specific utility.
Thank you. Representative Peterson, and then Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The location of this dam, is it in a highly seismic area
Are there, is there high probability of a large earthquake at some point? And if there is Talkeetna going to be put in jeopardy being, what, 30 miles downriver from this?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, one is in regard to seismic activity almost the entire state of Alaska, with exception of perhaps the North Slope is considered to be into a high seismic area. Talkeetna is approximately 90 miles downstream of this dam. There are currently tens of thousands of dams around the world. When our engineering consultants have looked at how many failures there have been because of seismic, they've been able to find only one case of a dam failure that occurred. That was when the dam was built on top of the actual fault line. And so that when the fault, you may have the earth go one direction on one side and the earth go a different direction on the other side. We have not identified any fault lines from the previous geotechnical work under this site. And so if it's built, we're pretty confident that it will stay there. And you'll certainly, there are a large number of dams in very populated, very seismic areas around the world. And dams do not fail for seismic reasons.
Thank you, Representative Tuck.
And this is more comments, but I'm going back to Representative Gatto's question on past dams. I know there was the Rampart Canyon Reservoir that was looked at one time, but that's damming up the Yukon River, and that's not doable. And that was actually only the Central North America Water and Power Alliance that was done back in 1967 by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. And prior to that, with the North America Water and Power Alliance, and then they identified Susitna Dam as being one. This is back in the 50s and the 60s. And that was, I think, done by the Army Corps of Engineers. And along with that was Chalitna Dam, Tanner Cross Dam, and Dawson Dam. And I don't know what's the status of those three, but I think that they found out those were non-doable, too, primarily probably because of the fish issue that we don't have with the Susitna. And then one other thing I want to talk about is, you know, when we do hydropower, you know, when we bring the price of power down to where we're at right now, you know, Anchorage may not see a reduction, but we won't see an increase, and we won't be as volatile with gas in the future, and so we'll be able to sustain that low cost of energy for a longer distance than we would be able to if we had it on natural gas.
Thank you, Representative.
Well, just comment on that. You know, someday, heaven forbid, we may run out of oil. Someday, heaven forbid, we run out of gas. I don't think we're ever going to run out of water, especially in Juneau.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Goad, did you have a question or a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With the Alaska Ratepayers Association, I appreciate you having them available to provide their comments in support of this project. I did want to have one comment, and I promised you that I wasn't going to talk about the bills that have been introduced in our in-house energy. However, I did want to address one issue on this concept of an independent agency to do this project. House Bill 103 and Senate Bill 42 do provide the powers for AEA to own a new project. And one thing that the Ratepayers Association may not know, and I plan on when I get back to Anchorage, sitting down with them and going over the bill, but one thing it does do is allow us to establish a subsidiary corporation for the purposes of owning a specific project. And so I think, as Mr. Noel had commented with respect to the agency has a statewide focus, and are we able to do a substantial new project with respect to all of the other work that we have to do? And it's of my opinion and working with the agency as a manager that we can. The other thing that we do address that in is through the fiscal note process, recognizing in order for us to take on a project like Susitna, we need more staff. And so there is a fiscal note that is set up to establish a project office and staff a project office to make this work. I mean, right now we have Brian, who is primarily, he's the lead engineer and the project manager for this. We have a contractor that is in a supporting role as an assistant project manager, and now that we have all these other contracts that are coming, contractors coming online, we know we need more staff in order to do this. So I wanted to assure the committee that we have thought about this stuff and we have been addressing it, and I will be talking to Mr. Noel and Mr. Wilson with respect to their concerns perhaps about the bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, this is Bill Noll. May I comment back?
Go ahead, Mr. Noll.
Thank you very much, sir. First of all, let me make it this point. I always look forward to talking to Sarah Fisher Goad. She is one of the more intelligent people in, I think, in our state agencies. Mike Harper, I have the deepest respect for his work, as I've known it over the past 20 years. So, and I acknowledge, I know that Sarah's reference to existing legislation allows for the kind of direction that she described. And we would be very happy to sit down and talk with her and see how that plays out or how it would play out. It's going to be your decision, sir, along with the legislature and the governor, as to how it finally works. I hope that both Mike and Sarah wind up being part of that process in any way, shape, or form, because they're both great Alaskans and good staff members.
Thank you. Are there any other comments or questions? Go ahead, Representative Gatto.
We're talking about essentially a 40-mile lake that is currently not there, and we have no fish issues. But once a 40-mile lake is intact and arrives, I don't think there's any way we're not going to have fish in there because of people being people, that lake will be populated. So here's the question. If indeed we suddenly have some issues with fish in the lake, do we then fall under an additional federal agency or state agency that will be there to make sure that these fish are not harmed?
Mr. Chair, the Molsa Lake will contain a substantial amount of glacial water, and so it will still be a very cold and silty lake. And so it may become at some future date where fish are present. It will probably never be a large fish-type lake. Once you have the license and you get it constructed, if fish get introduced, it will not be affecting your license. At a future date when your license expires and you have to relicense, at probably 50 years later, there may be something put on in regards to the fish because of changing conditions. But for at least the first 50 years, it's doubtful that it's going to affect your operation of the dam.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've laid it out, just laid out the facts, and then the possible path forward you're not advocating, but this seems almost too good to be true. And when I see a situation like that, I start looking behind me to see what it is I'm not seeing. What is the downside of this that I'm not getting? Is there something I'm just missing here? Because it seems like a pretty decent proposal.
Mr. Chairman, it's the reason why it did not go forward in the 80s had to do with financing, as in the state did not have very much money at the time being, and we also had substantial clean gas from the cooking that region. Our clean gas is quickly disappearing, and we are in a better financial position than we were in the 80s. The downside is you still have to, for this project to occur, the utilities do not have the funds themselves to do this project or the other generation projects that would be required along the rail belt. And so the downside is the state would at some point have to contribute some amount of capital to the project.
And just looking on the slide on page 9, it looks at the term of rate of 6%, term of 30 years. If the expected life is 100 years or more, is it possible to reduce the impact of the financial drain of the state by extending out the duration of the loans or the bonds?
Mr. Chairman, I'll let Sarah Fisher Goad answer that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That slide, we kind of agonized over how to present that because it's a bit premature for us to talk about how it could be financed in the best effort. As Brian mentioned, one of the things that we've looked at is would the state want to be in a position of buying the power down at assuming a 50% capital contribution, or would we want to buy the power down to a certain cost at like a wholesale rate, which would, you know, maybe be at a higher level, thus less than 50%. And the 30-year payback, yes, that's a legitimate question with respect to how we could do this. We could have bonds that could be outstanding much further than 30 years. We've kind of used loosely based on what we've called the Bradley model, which is this idea that the state participated in 50% of the project financing, and the debt that's outstanding is paid for by the utilities through a power sales agreement with the Alaska Energy Authority. One thing that happens when that debt is paid off in 10 years is that utilities continue to pay to the state $12 million a year. It's approximately the debt service cost now back to the state for essentially future projects. So in some respects, even though the state put that 50% up front, the state is recouping it very, very late. So it's a bit of a different model, but it's one model that we know we're comfortable with. The utilities understand that model. So that's kind of the basis of our model. And because this preliminary decision document and our meetings down here, we've actually been well received with respect to the understanding and explaining why Susitna and not Chacachamna, that a lot of other questions have come up with respect to, okay, what's next and what do we need to do? And I was kind of in making, you know, somewhat light of it that I think the legislature is expecting maybe in a couple weeks that we have signed power sales agreements, a financing plan, and a FERC license. And, you know, of course, there's a lot of work to be done on this. But we have started discussions. There are utility members who were down in Anchorage, or in Juneau, who we have had some preliminary discussions with. We are actually even tomorrow going to have some discussions with respect to getting some information on from them on who would be committed to purchasing the power. I've talked to the Commissioner of Revenue with respect to really starting to talk with the state and that department with respect to how we should be financing this project and what avenues to go with that. So we are starting to, you know, make a lot of progress with respect to all, you know, the additional work that we need to do. You know, we can't 100% say how this should be structured. There's a lot of questions out there.
So I'm just going to get ahead of myself then, right?
So, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you don't mind, if we go back to the rail belt demand for hydropower, rail belt demand hydropower, I thought I got this graph. Maybe I never got it, or maybe I just forgot it. But the demand in the summertime increasing. You know which one I'm referring to? Yeah, that one right there.
Mr. Chair, it should be the demand is greatest in the wintertime. And so I believe that the upper curve is the highest point during the winter months.
But then we look, and so the red line being Susitna-Watonna, that is how much load is being created? Or is that a demand?
Mr. Chair, that's actually energy being produced during the summertime. So it has Watonna and Chacachamna would produce the most energy during the summer months because of the environmental conditions on the license. The flow of the Susitna River would have to remain high during the summer months so that salmon that are downstream can go into the sloughs and into the streams downriver, and that you'd have a lesser effect on what the navigation on the Susitna River would be lower down. So just because environmental conditions, you would have to have the higher flows and also higher, so you would end up with higher generation during the summer months.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair? All right, so let me summarize this, make sure I catch it. Therefore, there's going to be more activity on that dam due to the fact that you're releasing more water. But doesn't mean that that's how much is going to be consumed. It's just going to be extra power that's going to be generated because of those environmental concerns?
Mr. Chair, it's extra power in the case of Watonna, because all the water that goes downriver will go through the turbines. The line that you'd be producing in terms of energy from the project is less than what the normal demand is, and as demand increases during the future years, it will become even greater, so that all the energy that will be produced by Watonna, including the summer months, would be sold. And during the time periods where you have the high output from Watonna, the utilities will typically take some of their other gas plants or other ones and take them down for maintenance and do work at that time, since they don't need the power from those projects at that time.
Thank you for the clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I don't see any other further questions or comments. I just wanted to, as I mentioned earlier, with SB 220, Governor's Office is going to be putting out the energy report by January 31, so we'll be looking at that down the road next week. And then, of course, HB 103 will be taking that up at a later time as well. Next week, on February 1, Tuesday, we've got AEA coming in for the Emergency Emerging Energy Technology Fund, as well as the Renewable Energy Fund. And then on Thursday, February 3, we have presentations by the Alaska Energy Authority on energy efficiency and conservation efforts, and also the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation on energy efficiency, energy rebates, and weatherization programs. So with that, we appreciate your coming in and giving us this overview and asking or answering our questions, and we'll adjourn this meeting.